Hey there, how's it going? Seth here. Before we get into today's show, I wanted to let you know about the Seller Financing Masterclass. That's right, this is a brand new course from RE Tipster. You can see everything you need to know at sellerfinancingmasterclass.com. If you're a buyer or seller, and if you've ever wondered what kind of potential there is in buying or selling your properties with seller financing, or maybe you've even tried to do this before, but something about it just didn't go that well. Believe me, there are a ton of things that can and will go wrong with seller financing if you don't really understand what you're doing. I experienced this firsthand early on in my career, and I know many other real estate investors who have been through a very similar thing, all because they took some course that told them to do seller financing, but it didn't actually explain the ins and outs of how to do it properly. And I know even more real estate investors who won't even touch seller financing because they're terrified of it. And that's why I created the Seller Financing Masterclass, because I know what an amazing tool seller financing is as a real estate investor, and I also know all the pitfalls of doing this the wrong way. I've seen a lot of folks get into seller financing, particularly in the land investing space, without really understanding how to do it properly, how to screen and underwrite borrowers, how to set up the right terms and conditions in their loan documents to keep them in control, how to find a quality attorney in their state or handle the foreclosure process if they need to, and sometimes without even knowing the best ways to collect payments and manage their note portfolio. And when you don't know how to address all these things, seller financing isn't going to go well for you. And at this point in my career, I have been shocked at how many people are doing seller financing wrong because nobody ever explained the finer details to them. And believe me, there are some very important details you need to know. They're not particularly difficult or complicated, but you do need to know them. It's not enough to just try to do a seller finance deal without understanding which steps you need to go through to get the job done. And in the Seller Financing Masterclass, we're going to fix all of that so you understand exactly what to do. And what's even better is that it's not just my expertise you're going to be learning from. You're going to hear it from several other experts who are very astute in how to handle the ins and outs of owner financing. And also, very important, the goal of this course is not to push you to do seller financing for every deal. In fact, depending on your goals, seller financing oftentimes won't be the right fit. And my goal is to help make sure you understand when it makes the most sense so that when you want to go there, you'll have the best set of instructions on how to implement this. This is your doorway to an amazing opportunity in the real estate business. And I should also mention, if you enroll now during this initial launch phase we're in, you'll get a nice big discount on this course. So again, just go to sellerfinancingmasterclass.com. And you'll see everything you need to know. And with that, let's get into today's show. Hey, everybody, how's it going? This is Seth Williams, and you're listening to the RE Tipster Podcast, episode 168. Show notes for today's episode can be found at retipster.com/168. So today I'm talking with my new friend, Joe Roberts. So Joe is a former Marine Cobra helicopter pilot who began his real estate investing journey while on active duty. And he started acquiring single family and small multifamily rentals before making the switch to flipping land in 2021. Joe left the Marine Corps after 11 years in 2023 to pursue real estate full time. He is married with 5 kids. And today I want to be talking with Joe about cold calling for land investors. Joe actually owns a company that does this. It's called landcaller.com. And up to this point in time, cold calling is not a major marketing medium that has been commonly used in the land investing world. Perhaps that's going to change after this, but the first time I ever heard about the idea of cold calling a couple of years ago, I honestly thought it was a little ridiculous. It was like the marketing strategy of last resort, something I didn't really want to know or understand. But the truth is, this can actually be incredibly fertile ground for land investors. And I think it's the kind of thing where direct mail has been so easy for so long that there wasn't a need for anything else. But as the competition has really heated up over the past few years and response rates have been going down, a lot of us have been looking around for the next thing and wondering about what else might be able to pick up the slack. And Joe has about as much experience with this as anybody I know with cold calling in the land investing world, which is, you know, definitely a niche in itself. So, you know, as I think we're going to find, there's a compelling case to be made for cold calling in the land business. And we're going to talk about all that right now. So, Joe, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thanks, Seth. I am doing great. It's great to get on here finally. I still remember before I'd ever launched Landcaller, reaching out to you and asking, "Hey Seth, who does cold calling for land investors?" And you're like, "Nobody that I know of."
So yeah, that's right. A lot of times before we get on these kinds of calls, like when I'm going to talk to somebody like this for the first time, I'll go into my email inbox and just like do a search for their name or email and be like, have I ever talked to this person before? Maybe I didn't know them, but I just got an email from them and you were there and I saw that first conversation. So it's kind of funny.
Yeah. I mean, that really started the track, because that was when I decided like, yes, I want to do cold calling after kind of proving it myself, but I didn't want to do it myself. And I didn't want to just hire a VA to do it for me either, because I tried that and it didn't work very well. And, so I was like, well, if anybody knows a company doing this, Seth does. Yeah. And you were like, no, nobody that I know of.
Yeah, looks like that's changing now that you're around. But I wonder, what made you even decide to think of this? Like, in my mind, cold calling was just like, no, like, I don't ever want to go there. That just sounds like a horrible existence to try to do this and find deals. So, like, is it because you had been sending out mail and it wasn't going well? Or, like, what made you even think to do this and then actually put all the effort into trying it and figuring it out?
I mean, mail and how it kind of went throughout 2021 played a big role. So, when I started in 2021, mail was easy. Probably not as easy as some guys that had started in 2017, 2018, 2020. But, I mean, it was pretty easy. I was landing some great deals. I just noticed as the year progressed, and 2021 was obviously the year of real estate crazy appreciation across the board of basically every asset class, you know, as things kind of got crazy post-COVID or through the lockdowns. And just as the year progressed, things that had worked initially or that I had maybe hadn't worked in, my campaigns took some tweaking. But once I had gotten them working, there was a good almost year where, you know, they were running on full cylinders, and then things just started to tick down. And so I tried changing up my types of offers, blind to ranged. I tried changing up the different types of mailers, what I was writing in the letters, postcards, and I just wasn't getting the same kind of metrics and return that I had before. And so, you know, spending all that time looking at it, and obviously direct mail is very expensive. I was sending, you know, not nearly as much as some people, but I was still doing about 10,000 to 15,000 letters a month. So that's expensive.
Yeah, that's a lot.
So it's like, you know, what are my other options essentially? So there was SMS, pay-per-click, cold calling. I mean, I was basically just Googling like ways to generate off-market real estate deals. What kind of landed me on cold calling, or at least wanting to try it, was I did a deep dive into my seller profile, is what I called it. So I basically went back through my last year of mail and I took every positive response to a piece of mail, even if I had never ended up getting it under contract, but a positive response. And I just kind of categorized these people and it was like, okay, what do these people look like? And they're primarily boomers. So they're seniors. Many of them did not have cell phones or still had landlines that they used primarily that I was, you know, calling them back on when they received mail. You know, they owned their property free and clear. You know, in my dealings with them, a lot of them didn't necessarily trust tech. I wouldn't always be able to get DocuSign or whatever with them. I'd have to send contracts out after we negotiated over the phone. There were people that were comfortable talking on the phone. And so to me, that was, SMS was kind of the sexy thing that people were kind of moving to at the time. But I thought that at least for my sellers in my markets, cold calling was going to be a better way to get to them. So I tested it out myself, had some really good success. I wasn't doing it at any sort of scale. In fact, I was pretty hyper-localized at in a very specific area that I wanted deals, but I at least kind of proved the model to myself. And that's when I started to kind of explore different ways to scale it into my business.
And maybe we talk just a little bit about, like, why did you even start doing land in the first place? Sounds like you started doing single family and multifamily houses like many people tried to do. Was that not going well, or what even led you to start searching for something else?
Actually, I mean, it went very well. I had a single rental, which had been a primary residence. And then when the Marine Corps had given me orders and moved me to another state, we kept it, rented it out. And I had that single rental plus my primary residence for many years. When I started buying single family homes and small multifamily in late fall of 2019, I just had those two homes. And by summer of 21, I was up to 23 doors. So in about 19 months, I had owned 15 properties.
That's amazing. Nice job, man.
Thank you. So it went well. First of all, I think you can only scale so much with single family before kind of the economies of scale get to you, even if you have property managers, which I did prefer that, because even property managers require managing and there's always something going wrong with every house and that requires your attention. And then honestly, I just looked at the real estate market in general as kind of 2021 really took off. And I just didn't, I thought it was getting pretty bubbly, to be honest with you. And I was also getting outbid on all my projects. I was doing the BRRRR model, as I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with, where you buy it with cash, renovate it, and then refinance and rent it out so you can use the cash again on the next deal. So I was finding very crappy and fixer-upper properties. But as 2021 kind of kicked off, coming out of 2020, I just kept getting outbid on everything by flippers who could buy it for less basis than I could because they were going to put lipstick on a pig, whereas I needed to make, you know, significant capital improvements sometimes because I wanted it as a long-term asset. So I couldn't find good deals that penciled anymore. I felt like the market was getting bubbly, so I kind of just stopped for a while. And I met JT Olmsted at a conference by chance, Bigger Pockets Conference. We sat down at lunch at the same table. I'm sure your listeners know JT, fantastic guy.
Mm-hmm.
I know he's been on here, I think, a couple times. But he was like, hey, you know, what do you do? What do you do? And we got talking about land, and it just fascinated me. I'd been sourcing off-market deals for single family with mail, so I had an understanding of sourcing off-market leads. All I needed to do was kind of tweak it for a new asset class.
So it was kind of because of JT that you discovered land?
Yeah, but it was 100% because of JT.
Wow, that's crazy.
We had that lunch talk, and then I was just fascinated, and I hit him up later that day. I was like, can I buy you a drink and talk more about it? So we went to the bar that evening, and I think we talked for a couple hours, and I was hooked, and I went back and started my land company.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. Those conferences, if you really make an effort to, like, even if you don't make a conversation, if you just are around people like that and have open conversations, like, it's crazy the connections you'll make and the people you'll meet. Like, every time I go to this thing, it's like, I know something cool is going to happen. I don't know what that's going to be yet, but, like, I always walk away from them with some, like, aha moment or, like, relationships that can turn into, like, stuff that lasts for years. So that's just, it's cool to hear.
JT's still a great bud of mine. I use Your Land Loans, his service, and I still, you know, pop ideas off of him to get feedback. So great, dude.
Let's get more into this cold calling stuff. So when I think about cold calling, is this something that I should be using in conjunction with other marketing mediums? Like, should I be doing this in addition to direct mail or texting or ringless voicemail or emails or whatever? Or, you know, are most of your customers using just cold calling? Like, that's the main thing that they're doing and nothing else. And I guess if it is used in conjunction with something else, where would this show up in the sequence? Is it the first thing you do or the last thing you do?
Yeah. So before I kind of answer that, let me back up a little bit and discuss how I kind of view there's two types of cold calling. I kind of break down into two categories. There's cold calling that is the equivalent of you handwriting letters, essentially, which should be, is you calling or somebody that's highly trained, excellent negotiation skills, knows the business in and out. That doesn't work at scale. So that works for you have that specific subdivision, that specific area within a county. You know you want deals, and maybe it's 20, maybe it's 50, maybe it's a couple hundred lots, but it's doable. You can be highly focused, and, you know, it's something that you could be just individually pulling the data on a property, finding the owner, skip tracing them, calling them yourself. That is one type of cold calling. That's not what Land Caller does, because what we're trying to model is essentially the direct mail, mass mail model for lead generation, which is out of 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 records, you find those few that are, you know, ready to make a good deal that pencils for the investor. So that's what Land Caller does. And in as that method of lead gen, it really can work either way. Our clients are almost 50-50 between those that use only cold calling and then those that use cold calling plus something else. Some of them are an all of the above. I find those clients tend to be a little bit more experienced. They have their honey holes, their markets, and cold calling works really well because they're going back to the same areas time and time and time again. And now they're hitting it from every possible area or angle, right? And if there's a Venn diagram of all the owners in a county, you know, there's overlap between those that are going to respond to SMS, those that are going to respond to mail, those that are going to respond to a cold call. But when you hit it from all sides, you could really take advantage of trying to capture everything else. 50% of our clients just use cold calling. And I would say at least half of those used to use other methods and just switched completely to cold calling because of some of the cost efficiencies, the agility of the model with, you know, how quickly you can kind of adjust things. So it's an either or, really.
correct me if I'm wrong, but so it sounds like when you were first testing this out to see, does cold calling work at all? Like, is there anything here? Was it just you in like a spreadsheet running it through something like direct skip, getting their phone numbers? You would call them personally and go through these conversations and see if it led anywhere. And that's kind of how you decided, okay, there's something here. Maybe we should scale this now and do this other way where we, you know, have less specialized people doing the initial call and that kind of thing. Is that kind of how it panned out?
Yeah. So, you know, there was a little bit, you know, I didn't kind of have this idea of the different types of cold calling formulated in my mind then. So, but yes, that's, I was basically using that first model I spoke about, and I was calling, I mean, I was very rudimentary. I was using land ID or the GIS to find the, I'd look at a lot, be like, I want that lot in a specific area, use truepeoplesearch.com to find a number and cold call them. Again, unless you're hyper-focused on a specific subdivision or whatever, that's a terribly inefficient waste of time for you to be trying to find deals yourself. So then I tried to hire, yes, I tried to use some of my VAs to cold call. So I was like, I'm paying them a lot less than I would want to pay myself to do this, so let's use them. What I quickly discovered, even though they had good English and they were, you know, they were comfortable on the phone, in having my VAs cold call, there was a whole lot more that kind of went into doing it at, even at a small scale within like internal to the company. So I quickly realized I had basically hired myself as a cold call center manager at a small scale, which I didn't particularly enjoy. I don't think I was particularly good at. There was a lot of tech aspects. I'm not a very techie guy with the dialer system and all that. And so that was actually when I reached out to you, because I was like, okay, I just want cold call leads is what I really want. I think, you know, I'd proven a bit to myself that yes, cold call leads can work. I just want a bunch of cold call leads. And that's when I started my search for a cold call company that worked for land investors.
I mean, I know there's other cold call agencies out there that work for like house investors and that kind of thing. But to my knowledge, I think you're the only one that does the land specifically, right?
Yeah. And that was what I discovered, you know, talking to you, JT, some other people I knew in the space. I was like, yeah, I haven't heard of anything like that existing. So I interviewed three or four of those kind of real estate cold calling companies, very popular with like wholesalers for single family homes. And I mean, they were good. They follow much the same model that we do at Landcaller. It was just when I tested them or when I interviewed them, I just didn't get a feeling that they understood kind of the intricacies of vacant land. A couple of them I had their caller kind of call me and I ran through some things with them. And I didn't get the warm fuzzy that like they really understood the niche. These callers have been calling kind of single family homes forever, and they were just very much focused on what that looked like. And so I was about to hire one regardless and just figured, you know, over the months we'll work out and hopefully my caller sticks with me and we can get that caller comfortable with the vacant land niche. And then I was just talking to my wife and I'd seen something on Twitter about starting your own call center. And I was like, well, what if we just started a call center, hired a manager, so I'm not managing it. I'm sure I could find other land investors that would want to do this so that, you know, I make the investment worth it and go from there.
It makes me wonder, is there anything different about how you build your list in the beginning and ultimately decide which people to call? Like, do you only go after higher value properties or property owners that fit a specific criteria, like being more likely to respond on the phone or anything like that? Or is it literally just take the exact same list you would normally send mail to and just give that to you and go from there?
Really? So we have clients that do we have every type of land professional at this point as clients. We've got large scale, like big time developers looking for vacant land. We've got land specific agents, plenty of flippers, those focused on larger acreage and doing subdivides and stuff, but those focused on infill lots and flipping them to developers and builders. So the only difference I would say is that because it is quite a bit cheaper than mail, you don't necessarily have to spend as much time scrubbing it or, you know, upfront doing so much work. Because I know flippers, I never did this, but I know flippers who had a team of VAs who pre-scrub all their lists prior to mailing. They're looking for slope, wetlands, landlocked stuff. And they've got multiple people working on this, going like looking at the properties in Land ID or GIS. And it makes sense because they've worked out the economics of mailing for, you know, all in cost of 70 cents a record or what it may cost to mail, versus hiring a VA for $4 or $5 to do that. With cold calling being about 60% cheaper on average than direct mail, there's really not a need to do that. So that's kind of the only difference I see in how you may have to prep a list or go after a list. Cold calling works for the same types of properties that direct mail does. It's just, it's cheaper. So if you don't want to spend the time scrubbing it up front, you don't have to.
Well, that's interesting. So, I mean, that right there is something that it makes sense now that I hear you say that, but I wouldn't have assumed that, not having knowing any better. But like you said, that cold calling is 60% cheaper than mail. So what does that break down to? Like, what is the cost per call for somebody to dial a number? And because I guess that doesn't include people that hang up or don't answer, right? It's just making an attempt to reach someone.
Yeah. So I look at more as a cost of kind of per record. So a record is going to return multiple numbers, obviously, once it's skip traced. And not every record's going to be skip traced. Just like when you pull a list, not every piece of mail is going to be delivered. But if you look at a list of 10,000, like that was a pretty standard month for me, mailing, all in cost, including property records and mailing and stuff, depending on how much bulk you're buying, you know, between 65 and 70 cents a record. So you're looking at 6,500, 7,000, 7,500, depending on what scale you're doing it. Whereas all in cost for calling 10,000 records with land callers about 3,000 to include like the property records and the skip tracing and the TCPA scrubbing and all that, and the caller working full time on the campaign. 3,000 to 7,000 is kind of the comparison there.
So I guess like in terms of a land investor scrubbing their list before they hand it over to you, I guess they would just kind of go through their usual steps, like take off the stuff that you absolutely know you don't want, or stuff that you're 100% sure are not going to work with you, like a government agency or something. Is that it? Or should they be doing more or less? Or is there any notable difference in how they should be processing that before they put it in your lap?
No, not really. Again, that kind of depends on the flipper and what their strategy is. But no, a good chunk of our clients, we pull the list for because we can get the data for cheaper than they can because we're buying in bulk, like DataTree data. So we'll take their criteria. We'll pull the list based on their criteria and then skip it and scrub it. But I mean, other than like the common sense things, like you're not trying to call the Forest Service for their, you know, 50 acres in your county. No, you don't. There's no need to really scrub it out any more than that. And that's also something that we can scrub out when we get it. So there's really not even a need if you don't want to scrub it. Our goal, to be honest, is whether you're incorporating cold calling with other lead gen methods or we're your only lead gen method. And this, to me, this should be the goal of any cold calling company that you potentially go with, is to be kind of I call it as a Marine Corps background, a fire and forget weapon system. So it can be as involved as you do as much scrubbing as you want on the front side. But if you don't want to, you can fire and forget it. You can give us the county and the criteria and the acreage size, and then you forget about it until warm leads start showing up into your CRM.
So maybe that's a good segue to help us understand. Take us through the cold calling journey. Like, what exactly does land caller do? And at what point is it dropped into the lap of the land investor? Like, how many calls does it take for this entire journey to first contact the person to actually like close the deal? And which of those calls are handled by your team? And at what point is like, okay, here's the information we got. You run with it now, land investor. How does that work?
Great question. So we are lead gen. We're not negotiating lead gen with some due diligence, caveat, some due diligence. Okay. And that's based on the flipper as well. You know, we individualize our scripts. We'll work with our client as, you know, to build their script out, split test things with them, you know, let them know what we've seen work, et cetera. There's any number of qualifying questions or whatever that they could put into the upfront script so that it does or does not get passed along as a lead. Right. But when you think about, okay, what does a cold call lead look like when it comes from the cold call center? It's going to look the same as when you sent out a mailer and let's say you had an answering, like Answer First or somebody answering the phone and taking down that information, which then gets sent to your email or your CRM. That's the same kind of place where you're picking it up and taking it. So you have somebody who's interested. If you've got qualifiers in terms of things that you do or don't, you know, you didn't want, then it's not passed along. But if you have some due diligence questions in there, for instance, I'm running a campaign now. I know in this area, I don't want any of the HOA properties that are in this area. So that's one of my qualifying questions. Is it an HOA? Answer is yes. I don't see the lead in my CRM. It's not a lead. So the negotiations and all that is on the client because they all have different strategies, right? Like I said, our clients are vastly varied. And even within the flippers, we've got very different strategies. We've got folks that they just want to buy cash at 35% of market value. That's all they're looking to do. And then we've got folks that are like, yeah, I'll put it under contract at 60% of market value and wholesale it and make 20K. Sure, why not? So we don't get into the business of negotiating for our clients.
So I guess maybe one question is, how many phone calls is this process? And like, which of those phone calls is handled by you and which of them is handled by me as the land investor?
We will have one phone call ultimately with the lead. Maybe two if like we call them, we start the conversation and they have to call us back. So we pick it up later. But once we've got the information that's on the script or the information the client requires for their CRM, we pass it off. We're done calling. On the client side, it typically looks like two or three conversations, maybe more, you know, based on, I'm sure we've all had those leads, even with direct mail, where you go back and forth on negotiations because you're pretty close for a little bit. But typically what it looks like, I'll use my land of business as an example. And my partner in Landcaller, John Lowry, also a land flipper with his own land business, he does it very similarly. So when the lead comes in, our first callback is rapport building plus more due diligence. So, you know, the lead came in, my VAs have pulled the deed, they've run the comps. Based on my script, we know, we ask the question, hey, what are you hoping to get for this property? So if they gave an answer, we have that number. We have other questions that kind of get after what level of motivation the lead might have, which helps us to prioritize who we're calling back. But that first callback is really to build rapport, build a relationship, be likable on the phone, and then answer additional due diligence questions, which help us really pinpoint the value on improvements, any number of standard due diligence questions. I mean, most of them come from the RE Tipster due diligence checklist straight off there. So anything that didn't get asked on the cold call is asked then. We don't make an offer on that call. Some investors do because like they've pulled comps. They know what they want. In my business with my sellers, I have found a higher conversion rate if I just use that call to get them to like me and to get the information. And I come back on a third call when I'm actually making an offer. I think it comes across, I have a theory, it comes across as a little bit more professional. It gives time for the relationship to develop a little bit more. So I'm making a third call, which is, you know, including the first cold call. So cold call from land caller, follow up, rapport building, due diligence call, and then offer call.
So no, that's helpful. So to recap, three calls. Call number one, that's what land caller handles. And that's ultimately the lowest value call. Like that's where, I don't know what percentage, but a large percentage of people probably will not fit the bill and like the biggest time waster. If you were trying to do this yourself,
yes,
that would take you the most
exactly.
time. And once you actually have verified, I don't know what you ask, like, are you interested in selling below market value or how you ask the question? But it sounds like by the time it's delivered to the land investor so that they can pick up call number two, in order to do that, they're armed with the knowledge that yes, this person said they're interested in selling at a discount and not in the HOA or whatever other basic questions they want answered. Is that accurate?
Yeah, because so to give you an idea, I mean, so again, a caller on a campaign for us, they're working full time for that campaign, 40 hours a week, calling all day long with a multi-line dialer. We're changing out the numbers up to twice a week, and they are going to make around 3,000 to 5,000 dials per day on average. And they're going to contact typically 200 to 300 people. And in a month, they'll send about 60 to 70 leads. It really, the number of leads has a lot of variables, but I would say that's our average. Smaller lots, lower price points have higher lead gen than more sophisticated big lots with high price points, you know, a few hundred K type price points. But I'd say our average is around 60 to 70 leads in a month. You're going through a lot of numbers and a lot of dials to generate those leads, which is where the economies of scale kind of work themselves out.
Yeah. And having a lead doesn't mean it's going to be a deal. It doesn't mean that they're going to sell for any specific price. It just means like, hey, this is the one to pay attention to. Like there's a hot one on the line here. And then on that second call, it sounds like it's a mixture of rapport building and also just verifying the facts. So, and you know, there's a link to the phone call checklist that I put together years ago. We still use it today. You can get a free PDF of it if you want, but that's kind of like the list of stuff that you want to verify, just understanding the facts. Am I correct in assuming that a lot of that stuff you can sort of find out on your own before you call the person back? And like, for example, does this property have road access or is it in a flood zone or whatever the question might be? So is the idea like on that second phone call, you're not necessarily asking all those questions, but you're verifying what you already think you know. Like, it looks like this property doesn't have road access. Is that right? Or am I mistaken? Like that kind of thing?
Yeah, 100%. So I'd say it's three aspects to that. One is like, how much work do you want to do on the lead prior to asking them? And so that's a time value equation there. Like, how many VAs do you have working for you? Are you doing it yourself? Like, do you really want to go pull every deed, every plat, look at every GIS for every lead prior to calling it back? Maybe you do, but there could be some things where you're just like, I will ask. And then if it turns out we're close on price, because I haven't made an offer yet, I can now go verify it before we go make an offer. Then there's the aspect of just using those questions, and that's verifying, like you said, but also just using it to have the conversation as you're, a lot of these cold call leads, they're relational people. It makes sense. They picked up a phone. They picked up a call from a random number and talked to somebody for 5, 6, 7, 10 minutes. And now they're talking to you again. Sometimes they just want to tell you the story about their land. They want to tell you like, oh yeah, you know, when they went to their grandfather's lot to go hunting when they were a kid. And so being just an active listener, and then just some of the questions are just an opportunity to get them talking. And again, to get them to like you. I mean, I'm sure you've had this with direct mail leads, Seth, but I've had many leads where they say something like, I've had higher offers in the past, but I want to sell to you because I like you. Maybe they're blowing smoke, but I get that more often with cold call leads because they are relational people. So it's a verifying of facts, or it's a, you know, getting the facts if you don't want to spend too much time on the front end before calling them back to do it. Although I recommend you do some due diligence. Like, when I call them back, I've got land ID up. I'm looking at the lot so I can ask them about things on the lot and that sort of thing.
And I think that's a good thing for people like me, or people who might be like introverts, or people who like just despise getting on the phone for any reason, to understand that like the point of phone call number two is not just to like check box. I mean, that's part of it, but it's also to like build a relationship with the person. You know, I can totally understand why that might be uncomfortable for some people, just like picking up the phone and talking to a stranger, but I'm sure it works wonders when you can humanize yourself in any way. And it sounds like, contrary to the way that direct mail works, how sometimes you get lots of hate from people and they just are livid. I mean, just illogically angry at you. When you have these kind of phone conversations, even when you get to call number three and you make the offer and it's below market value and they say no, how often do those turn into just vicious, hate-filled phone calls? Is it like a nasty experience, or is it like they're just more civil because you've humanized yourself and they almost kind of like you in a way because you've built a relationship? Is that accurate?
That's very accurate. Very accurate. I can count on one hand the number of people, even after making offers, which I knew we were going to be way far apart, that have even just hung up on me, let alone, I don't know that anybody's yelled at me. And to be fair, I also don't do a fair amount of my calls anymore because I've hired an acquisitions manager who I've trained to make these calls and that stuff. So we split, you know, my leads. But, you know, she's the same thing. She gives me reports every week on how the calls went. So it's exactly that. You've humanized. It's not some disconnected piece of junk mail that they've gotten that they feel like is a kind of a slap in the face, which is another reason I like giving the offer on the third call. If you give the offer right off the bat on the second call, it comes across as a little bit more just like business-like. Hey, yeah, you had that. You said you wanted to sell. Here's my offer. Will you take it or leave it? Type thing. That's why I don't know that it necessarily works as well with this type of lead. It filters, like, you are saving yourself some time. I will 100% give that. Like, you will filter out more leads. You will lose leads, though, that you definitely could have worked. And I feel like anybody who's doing this, regardless of what lead gen method you're using, should have follow-up drips. A lot of people that are doing mail, they'll drip their mail, right? Like, they'll send the mail, and then 3 months later, they'll send it again. But with cold call, it's nice because you've got their phone number. So it's very easy. Maybe you're 20,000 apart, but their motivation level is meh. But you call them back or text them, you've got their number. It's very easy to just put in a CRM or a Google Sheet and be like, all right, in 2 months, I'm going to hit them back up. You've already established that relationship. I've landed many deals in the last 2 months from calls that were made in March and April. 3 or 4 I can think of off the top of my head. The lead gen method works well with follow-up campaigns and drip campaigns.
So, I mean, aside from maybe the demographics and just the way that they interact with you, is there anything different about cold calling leads versus direct mail or texting or otherwise? Have we kind of covered it, or does anything else stick out to you? Is like, yeah, they tend to accept lower offers, or anything come to mind?
So a couple things. So for one, there are people that you're only going to get with cold calling because they either don't have a cell phone, so they're not going to, can't respond to SMS, or they just don't trust SMS. They're never going to respond to a text, and they never respond to mail. Many times I've had leads that said, yeah, I get junk mail all the time. I get letters every day of the week asking me to buy this property, and they all go straight in the trash. So there's one aspect is like there's a subsection there that are only going to be reached by cold calling. In terms of how the lead looks different, I would say this is if your business model is completely built on the self-filtering model of I send mail, really it's the blind offer, right? Like the kind of the least amount of work possible. I send the mail with the blind offer. I only get people that see that exact number and want to sell for that number. And then I bet and make sure I offer the right number that actually makes sense for the property once the lead comes in. This is different. It's not going to work the same. Now, there's some things you can do up front, like having that number or a range of numbers in that initial cold call conversation that our callers are having with them to pre-vet that kind of narrows the funnel to getting when it gets to you. But ultimately, a cold call lead, I would say, is slightly more work. Like you're probably having a few more, an additional, at least one additional conversation as you over on the phone that you would a direct mail lead. I mean, ultimately, I spoke on the phone with every direct mail lead I ever got. So speaking on the phone is just part of the business, regardless of what kind of lead gen method. You're just doing a little bit more with cold call leads.
I wonder, like, do cold calling leads tend to assume that you know more about the property or that you're smarter than if you were to just send them a blind offer, since a blind offer is such a, you know, impersonal cold thing. Like you're not really displaying anything about what you know about the property. Whereas with a cold calling sequence, like you've had these conversations with them, you've asked the questions, like you've had a chance to point out potential flaws in the property, not saying that their property is worthless, but it kind of plants the seed that, like, you know, this might not be worth as much as you think it is if it's landlocked and if it has these issues or that kind of thing. I don't know. Do they tend to just sort of accept what you're saying as reality easier because, like, you've sort of displayed your competence and that you know what you're talking about?
I personally would say yes. I don't necessarily have hard data to back it up other than anecdotal. And what I would say is, so first of all, we spend so much time, like, customizing these direct mail letters and, you know, throwing in the tidbits here and there. Ultimately, how, like, who's reading that whole letter? Probably. And who's, like, picking up on the things that we're trying to imply in the conversation of making ourselves an expert in the air or whatever? They're scrolling down until they see your big, bold price and then deciding, or whatever it may be, and deciding, you know, that they'll, or, hey, cash offer. So I feel like it's easier to kind of drop those hints or those implications that we are professionals in a conversation. So, for instance, like, one question that we script into a lot of our campaigns is it goes something like the cold caller says, as I'm sure you're aware. So right there, I love the psychology of cold calling, by the way, because it's fun to kind of just play with. But so right there, you're establishing yourself as an expert because you're about to bring the facts, but you're not talking down to them because you're telling them, as you know, that they're aware. And so when you bring the facts, the implication then is that this fact is true because you've just implied that they're aware of it. Okay, so that's how we start that sentence. As you're aware, as I'm sure you're aware, you know, land in this market, in your market, can take a very long time to sell, on an average of over a year for full market value. With that in mind, where would you say you're at with this property on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being get the highest possible price I can, and 10 being sell as quickly as possible? And so now, not only have you implied your professionalism and knowledge, you've implied that they also know this. So now they want to accept that because you've just implied that they're knowledgeable. And then you've also given them the opportunity to demonstrate what their motivating factors may be, while not necessarily having to say, feel like they're vulnerable and saying, oh yeah, I need to get rid of this thing as fast as possible. You know, because people, even people that don't understand sales or anything else, understand that when they do that, they give up leverage. But if they're just giving a number on a scale, they don't feel like they're giving up as much leverage. So the psychology there can work. And now when you get that lead into your inbox, now you can prioritize it. You can based on where on that scale they landed. But you can also take that and use that in negotiations, because you've already implied your company is a professional leader. So you call back, hey, I saw, you know, you answered one that you're interested at the highest possible price. Absolutely understand that. I'm not going to mess around with, you know, any low offers with quick closing timelines, understand highest possible price, a little bit more risk. I might need a little bit more due diligence. So you can use that to your advantage. And then they're assuming you had multiple price points. You took their input of, hey, I want the highest possible price. And that's what you're now offering. So even if it may not be look on the surface as like a lead, that might be any good. They're like, oh, I want the highest possible dollar amount. You can still use it in negotiation.
I'm wondering what percentage of these warm leads that you get end up as closed deals? And I know I hate this question. I feel bad that I'm even asking you this because it's a giant, it depends on how much you're offering and what you're looking for and on, but just to give people just a wild guess, like if I get 100 warm leads from Landcaller, what would be like maybe a percentage range that I could expect to actually close on those deals? Like how many of these callbacks and, you know, conversations would have to be had to actually like walk away with the deal? Would it be like maybe, I don't know, 5 out of 100 or 1 out of 100 or 20 out of 100 or any thoughts on that?
Well, it depends. So that is probably the most individual client or flipper or land professional dependent, right?
Yeah.
We have land flippers who are realtors. The vast majority of these leads or could end up, a high percentage of them can end up as clients for them because they're people interested in selling. They're realtors who also flip. So even if they can't, you know, buy it, they'll sell it for them. We've got land developers. All they want is like 15 to 20% off market value because they're going to subdivide the thing and build on it. So they get a nice high percentage. We've got flippers who use the kind of traditional model of, yeah, I just want to buy at 30% of market value cash and close in 30 days. I don't wholesale. I don't double close. I don't assign. They have the smallest percentage. I would say 2 to 5% of leads that come in. And then I'm a little bit of my business, I average about 8 to 10% conversion rate off my leads. But I'm a little bit of I'll get creative and find ways to do a deal. I don't have like a very strict, I need to purchase at this percentage of market value. Because a lot of that is predicated on the deal size, like that kind of like sub 100 or even sub 50K deal where you need to buy it at 30 to make it worth your time, right? But like if I'm calling for a lot that's worth 150K and I know I can sell it for 200K, am I really going to like only offer 40% of 150K lot? Like that's, if I could make 50K off of it with a quick wholesale, like no. So I would average higher than some of those other flippers because I'm willing to double close stuff, put it on a long due diligence period, see what happens if I could make 15, 20, 25K, or especially on higher price point properties, I'll take well above 50, 60% of market value and put it under contract. Because I'm going to make more money than I would on the property that I bought for 10K cash at 25% of market value, you know, on the same property. So I know that was kind of all over the place. But if your kind of land business looks similar to mine, I would say expect that 8 to 10, 7 to 10% conversion rate.
No, that's super helpful. And it sounds all over the place because it is all over the place. I mean, there's all kinds of different people using your service. So I appreciate the different examples there. That's really helpful. And one thing I will say, for those of you out there who are wondering, like, what exactly do I say in this conversation? Like, give me a script. Give me a word-for-word thing that I can use. So Joe and I actually worked together. I'm putting together a script. You can download it in the show notes, retipster.com/168. We'll have an email opt-in thing. You can download it there. We also had a completely separate and much more in-depth conversation about this where we even did some, like, role-playing and that kind of thing to explain, like, what does a call sound like? And Joe was very good at this stuff. And that's in module one of the Land Elite Masterclass, along with a bunch of other advanced strategies. So if you're interested in that, check out landelitemasterclass.com. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. Again, retipster.com/168. I'm wondering, who do you hire as these cold callers for Landcaller? Like, it sounds like they're not from the U.S. So I'm wondering, like, does it matter if they have a foreign sounding accent or anything like that? Or I don't know. Is that an issue or anything?
We've done some split testing with callers that we have that essentially have zero accent. Either they were born in America and they've moved back. And the split testing hasn't indicated that for that initial cold call, it really matters. There's not a statistical difference. I think it potentially matters more on the follow-up calls where now they're kind of getting down to brass tacks and deciding, like, they're going to, do they like you? Are they going to sell you the property? Trust is being established. But on the initial call, it doesn't seem to matter. So we have two centers right now. We had to open a second one to kind of keep up with demand that we opened up in Egypt. So we have a call center in Egypt, in Cairo, and then one in Manila in the Philippines, you know, classic offshore worker location. Both centers are in-person call centers. So the workers are coming into the center so we can keep things like, you know, internet speed, quality. We're trying to keep as many variables costs as we can. Internet, hardware, management by floor managers on the floor so we can QA things quicker and that sort of thing. And then we do a pretty extensive hiring process. So we only hire cold callers, first of all, with excellent English skills, little to no accent, a lot of our callers, and then they have previous real estate cold calling experience. So we have no newbie callers. And what a lot of them we're realizing come with is a pretty unique ability to mimic American accents, particularly Southern accents. And so they actually can sound almost undifferentiated from an American caller. And then we give them our own training package that we've developed, teaches them kind of the specifics of what land investing is, kind of what do our clients look like? What do these sellers look like? Who are these people you're going to be talking to? What is the process when it leaves here? So they kind of understand what's happening with the lead and why they're trying to get the lead and why they're trying to gauge motivation levels, those sorts of things. We do role playing with them and then we hire them on. You lose all of your kind of cost benefits or most of your cost benefits over other lead gen methods, particularly direct mail, if you try to onshore this and use American callers, because it is monotonous and tough work. You're dialing thousands of numbers a day and having hundreds of conversations a day. So to be able to do that at offshore prices versus US prices is the difference, really.
If I were to try to hire my own telemarketers in the Philippines or something like that, just take this on myself, like, why should I not do that? What are the biggest challenges of trying to find those people on my own versus just going with a kind of a proven entity that has all the kinks worked out?
I mean, I would say that kind of what I mentioned, when you do that, you're hiring yourself as a cold call manager. You just have to realize that and what all that entails. So there's the hiring process, finding somebody with experience, understands the space, or maybe they don't understand the space. They probably don't, but at least experience cold calling, make sure they have good enough English. Then there's the training. There's the figuring out, you know, the payment that you're going to use. You're going to go through Upwork or Wise or whatever you're going to use. Contract, training. How are you, you know, confirming what's their internet speed? What's their setup at their house? Do they have the right hardware for calling? Do they have a good mic? Do they have a quiet space? They're probably working at home. So is there going to be traffic in the background? Then there's the dialer system. So picking a dialer and understanding all the intricacies, because you're not going to do this with an open phone number. I mean, you could, but you're not going to get nearly that amount of volume you need to sift through all these numbers to find those leads, right? Like when we talk to clients that previously used VAs to cold call, and they're blown away by the numbers of people we're reaching. Like we're reaching more people in a week or two than their cold caller reached in 2 months. And it's because they're just using a single line dialer. They're just using an open phone number or whatever it may be, and just manually dialing numbers. So you want a dialing system. And that's, I don't even understand all that. That's why we have managers with 20 years experience that take care of that aspect, because there's all sorts of variables when it comes to the dialer, the settings you set up in there. There's maintaining TCPA, Telephone Consumer Protection Act compliance. Not necessarily compliance, because if you're making offers to purchase, you're not subject to it technically, but there's still a lot of rules around it that you want to follow to keep yourself out of trouble, even though you're not technically compliant. Then you've got training. So you got to make sure, like, how are you training them? You're doing follow-on training, because we do follow-on training weekly with all our callers. And then QA is an aspect of that too. Are you listening to calls, providing feedback to the caller, incorporating that into future training modules for the caller, and making hiring and firing decisions based off that? So, I mean, that's some, not all, the aspects of managing a cold call campaign at scale effectively.
No, that makes total sense. I know I actually work with a bunch of different individuals for various things in like maybe 7 total that come to mind immediately, but like, all of these people, I could have them be my own full-time employees, but like, there's just so much wrapped up in that, like the training and overseeing them and all the stuff It's way easier to just like outsource it to an actual company that does this, and then they can figure out all the HR stuff, and they already have the systems figured out. So it makes total sense to me.
And what I think people like, they just run the numbers of like, oh, well, I'm sure I could find somebody who can do this for $4 an hour. First of all, good luck. But if you can find a VA overseas for $4 an hour, whether they can do it as well remains to be seen. But then, so what's the price difference between them calling full time and us? Well, maybe let's just say it's $1,000 a month, all in cost. So what's your time worth for all those things that I talked about? Are you getting the same quality? So I feel like most people very quickly arrive at the conclusion that you're not really saving yourself anything by trying to bring this in-house most of the time.
What does it cost to hire a land caller at this point in time?
It's a little bit dependent on whether you are providing us a list or we're pulling it for you. So right now, so the caller themselves is just a flat fee for that full-time caller on your campaign. And that's $1,500 to $1,700 a month based on the length of the contract you signed with us. We go down to as short as a month-to-month contract for the highest cost. And then on the data side, we can pull the list based on your criteria, data tree data. That would be 4 cents a record. And then we will skip trace it and scrub it through a Telephone Consumer Protection Act scrubber, which removes all known litigators and their family and friends, essentially, and plaintiffs to the FTC. So essentially, anybody that's at possibility of causing us or you problems with litigation gets removed out of the list, so they're not being called. Which, just side note for all of the listeners who are either cold calling themselves, hiring a VA to cold call, thinking about hiring another cold calling agency, or texting, you should be doing that. Because it is, there. Go look on Facebook. There are groups with tens of thousands of people where they just teach people how to conduct TCPA litigation. Like, they don't even need to win in court. They can just file a suit, and then you, depending on at what stage of the process it works, or they decide to file, then gets served with a notice. So anybody dealing stuff on the phone should be doing that. Even though offers to purchase property are not subject to the TCPA, that doesn't keep anybody from filing a suit. And so it's very important to remove those litigators with a good software prior to it getting into your dialer. Anyway, that's 11 cents a record. So all in cost, if we were pulling your list, skipping it, scrubbing it, is going to be around, let's just say, 10,000 records in a month. $1,500 for that, because 15 cents a record, and then another $1,500 to $1,700 for the flat fee for the caller.
It's not that bad. I mean, you compare that to the cost of direct mail. It almost sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, but do you recommend that people have land caller pull the list and skip trace it and do all that stuff instead of me, like, get my list from Data Tree, running it through Direct Skip, and then I give it to you? Like, is it better for me to just put that all on you guys?
So we actually don't even allow people to give us skip trace lists anymore. We make some exceptions every once in a while. So the big reason there is we used to allow it, like, people to bring us their skip trace list. The problem is the quality of skip tracing available out there ranges widely. Let's just say that. And the vast majority of companies are all white hatting the same data. They're just putting their brand on it, and it's this white pages data, and it's not great. What we did is we just require that we skip trace the data, because for us, we can't perform for a client without good numbers. So it would made it very hard to pinpoint things going wrong with campaigns, split A/B test things if we don't know that we're getting good data back in the first place. So we pay more than your average skip tracer, because we use credit bureau data, which is a lot more expensive on average. We get it's bulk discount. That's why, somebody might hear that and say, oh, 11 cents for skip tracing. That's crazy. I paid direct skip, 9 cents or whatever it is. But even just a few percentage points of better, of more numbers that are accurate leads to, if that even leads to one more, you're talking about saving like a couple $100 versus one more deal for a year, for hundreds of thousands of numbers you're dialing, one more deal that lands you, 20,000. So that's why we require that we skip trace it. But yes, people can still bring us data. Lots of people have lists that they've been pulling forever. The land doesn't change hands that quickly. If you've got they've got a list, they want to bring us the list, by all means. But if you want to move into a new area where you're probably pulling it for cheaper than you are, so. And it's your data. We give it back to our clients. That's how our clients are doing, their own SMS campaigns and direct mail campaigns with the data that we pulled and skipped and gave back to them.
So like aside from TCPA stuff or known litigators and that kind of thing, are there certain types of property owners you simply won't call? Like, oh, we noticed there's this characteristic about this person, so we're not going to call them, or you shouldn't call them. Anything like that come to mind, or is that not a thing?
No, not really. I mean, and here's another tidbit for your folks that are doing cold calling themselves or hiring out themselves. Go ahead and call do not call list numbers. I see a lot of, or I talk to a lot of clients that, you know, used to do cold calling themselves maybe, or had a VA do it. Yeah, you know, half my list I can't use. And that's right. About half your list is going to be people on the federal do not call registry. You are not subject to that if you are calling them in order to ask them to purchase their property. There's multiple court cases you can look up that have established the TCPA does not apply if you are offering to purchase and you were not marketing. So if you're a realtor trying to find leads, it's a little bit different if you are trying to market yourself to provide a service to them. But if you're calling because you want to purchase a property, and some court cases have even established that putting it under contract with the intent to purchase it or even wholesale it also works, you can call do not call list numbers. So a lot of you out there listening to this, if you're cold calling, you're artificially limiting yourself to half your possible list by scrubbing out do not call folks from your list.
So what if I hire Landcaller and I pay you guys thousands to call people and no leads materialize or no deals are closed? Or I guess that's two different questions. But if, I mean, does that ever happen where people spend the money and like it just gets them nowhere? They just flush the money down the toilet. And if so, like how often does that happen? Why does that happen? Is it because people aren't following up fast enough, or is it because they're terrible on the phone, or any insights on people who try this and it doesn't work for them? If that ever happens, why doesn't it work for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm sure everybody has that in the back of their mind. So we have had one client to date that did not land a deal with us. We sent them close to 200 leads over the course of 3 months. No, actually, it was about 220 leads. They were averaging close to 80 or to 100 leads a month. I think it was 220 or 230 leads, and it was about 2.5 months of calling. I don't know why they didn't land a deal. I looked at their leads that were coming in. Some of them seemed plenty motivated. They were a relatively experienced flipper, also a realtor. I couldn't say. I had coaching calls with them where I, you know, tried to figure out what they might be doing differently. They ended up getting out of land flipping altogether, or at least stopping their business for a while. Not sure. We have had nobody else that hasn't landed a lead. We have people that have landed, obviously, like much fewer than our average conversion rate. That's why our average was there. But the biggest, probably, I'd say the biggest variable that you can control is, aside from your general strategy, which we talked about earlier, which is going to raise or lower what type of leads you're ultimately closing, is how quickly you're calling them back. So there was this is not the guy that didn't land any leads, but we had another client. I see a lead come in, and I see in the notes that he talks about how he wants to move out of state. He wants to get it sold quickly because he wants to go live with his kids. He's 80 years old, and he's got like 5 other parcels he wants to sell as fast as he can. This is all in the notes. And I'm like, so I hit him up on Slack. Every one of our clients, we set up a individual Slack channel for them where we communicate with them. We give them their daily KPIs, and they can ask questions and that sort of thing. So I hit him up on Slack. I'm like, hey, great lead. Like, let me know how that goes. Like, that sounds like a killer lead. He's like, yeah, I'll let you know. About a week goes by, hit him up. I'm like, hey, how'd that lead go? Oh, I haven't gotten back to him yet. I'm going to do it soon. I'm like, all right, man, like, get on that. That seemed like a great lead. About another 3-4 days goes by, hit him up. Like, hey, how'd that conversation go? Did you get all those properties locked up? Oh, man, I called him this morning and he went under contract with somebody last night for all of them. You're killing me, Smalls. Yeah. So
it's a good lesson though, that like
it's warm.
Yeah. I mean, these people are probably getting hit by other land investors giving them offers, and it's front of mind. Like, they're thinking of selling. So yeah, it's a good, question is like, what should the time limit be? Like, the second you get that lead, you got to call them within 24 hours, 48 hours. Like, I know the answer is as soon as possible, but
I try to do 48.
48. Okay.
Yeah. I try to do 48. We have a couple clients that we do live transfers with. And, you know, if we can't transfer to them, those clients are a little bit bigger. They have pretty built out, robust systems. But we're handing off the lead. Like, we go through some questions. And then we're, hey, do you have time to talk to a manager? And then we're handing the lead straight, you know, connecting the call. I mean, that's as warm as you get. But we haven't seen any data that actually indicates that that's necessarily any better at conversion rates than calling within 24 to 48 hours. Once you go past 48 hours, I think people start to kind of back to that, like, building, presenting a professional and serious face of the company that you represent. If you go past 48 hours, how serious are you? Like 72, if you're calling back a week later, like, are you, how serious are you about this transaction? Do you really want to buy it? It's, it may be the implication to some sellers there. So, I mean, when a lead's warm, you definitely want to follow up as quickly as you can. But I, yeah, 24 to 48 is what I do.
I'm not the expert that you are, Joe, but I would almost think 24 hours would like be exponentially better. I think back to like different real estate people I've called over the years, and psychologically, there is a difference when somebody calls me back like that day or like the next day. But once you start waiting like days or weeks even, it's like, okay, I've already written you off. Like I know I can't rely on you because you're not getting back to me. So I guess ASAP is the answer on that.
Yeah. ASAP is definitely best. Oh, it's the only kind of caveat is a lot of times our callers, we usually finish the conversation with, you know, our manager's going to call you back. Is there a good time? Or like what time of day works best for you? And so a lot of times the seller is giving us a convenient time, which may not be like this afternoon. But all things considered, yes, the sooner the better.
And another thing that comes to mind here is like the time commitment of calling people back. I mean, if I'm getting 100 warm leads a month, like that's got to take a lot of time to actually call those people. I mean, never mind the discomfort of it for the introverts out there, but just like the time of following up. So like if I've got, I mean, I know it doesn't all happen in one shot like this, but if I get 100 leads dropped into my lap, how much time should I set aside to make sure I'm following up with those people? Is it like 15 minutes per lead or 20 minutes or 5 minutes or what would you say?
Yeah, so I would say a little bit of that is what are you front loading that second conversation with? We kind of talked about that earlier. How much due diligence of online sources, open source sources are you doing on that lead before you call them back? How good are you with your systems? Like how quickly can you comp a property? So that's kind of a whole aspect which I'm not going to speak to because I don't like that ranges widely. I take about 3 minutes to comp a property. And I know people that'll take an hour to comp a property. At least I take 3 minutes to get a number that I'm comfortable off going under contract on. But I would say, you know, if that second call is about 8 to 10 minutes and then a third call is typically shorter because you make the offer, you know, you do a little chit chat, you make the offer, and then pretty quickly, you know, whether or not you're close and maybe there's a follow-up call or two to negotiate the last few thousand or not. So that one can typically be a little bit shorter. So I'd say 15 minutes is probably a pretty good average. So, you know, how do you manage that? I mean, first of all, 100 leads that'd be a pretty successful KPI. That would be abnormal. But even 60 leads, that's still a lot of time. So there's the things you do are you tighten the funnel on our end with our scripting. So you're only getting sent higher quality leads, which you just understand that there are leads that you don't get sent that you could have probably turned into deals, but you're just recognizing that you don't want to spend the extra time sifting through some of the other ones. Or you hire a VA to do a good chunk of it, because if your VA is doing a lot of that due diligence on the front side, it's very manageable to you know, carve out a couple hours in the day or in the evening when a lot of people ask to be called back in the evening. You carve out a couple hours and you just knock the phone calls out, you know, one after the other. But if you're working a full-time W-2 job and you're also trying to do all the GIS, land ID, deed registry pull, due diligence ahead of time, now you're probably running out of time to additionally do the phone calls. And so that's where a VA can really help you do those kind of monotonous tasks.
How knowledgeable are your cold callers about their clients? Like if I hire you and somebody's calling on my behalf, and the property owner's like, hey, I got you on the phone right now. Let's get an offer. Well, how much can you offer me? Like, are they authorized to throw any numbers out there? Or if not, like, how much information can they share about me before I get involved and start calling them?
Some of that's dependent on the client. So at a base level, they have standard responses. Hey, like, you know, we get some information, obviously, during our onboarding about the client, where they're based. And, you know, you're always a local company, right? That sort of thing. And they, you know, that buys and stuff. So they understand the standard land flippers company looks like, and they can answer questions that just kind of come up. Who are you? Why are you calling me about my piece of land I haven't thought about in 10 years in another state? Like they could answer those questions. In terms of like pricing, they will, unless it's a campaign where a client has provided us a pre-priced list and said, hey, either in the script, I want you to bring this price up, you're authorized to bring this price up during the call, then on a question about pricing, they're just going to demur. They're going to say, you know, we want to give you the most accurate offer possible because we want to make sure we're maximizing the return for you. So we need to get this conversation and then make sure that we accurately comp it before we offer you a price. And they'll just demur to the manager, which is the client.
I'm assuming you don't like record these calls, right? It's not like I get to listen to exactly what we said. There's just a few basic pieces of information that are passed along to me so I can kind of have some context for who I'm talking to.
So calls are recorded sometimes. Every state has different rules about recording conversations. So if we're allowed to record them, they are recorded. There's not an easy way to get recorded calls to the client that doesn't take a lot of man hours. So providing with the lead, a recording of the call to every lead is not something we do. That being said, we use the recorded calls, most importantly, for quality assurance. So we have a whole quality assurance team, which is listening to calls, a percentage of calls from every caller on a weekly basis, providing grades to that caller, feedback, and then follow-on training. They're important for the QA aspect. And then if it was a place where we could record it, we had the recording. If something in the caller's notes doesn't make sense or something, you know, the client calls them back and just what the caller or the seller's saying now is not jiving with what the caller said they said on the initial call, we can pull that call on kind of a case-by-case basis and provide that recording to the client so they can, you know, kind of parse through what the issue may be. I mean, that doesn't happen very frequently, but that is something we've provided for clients before.
When I jump in and do call number two, does it matter which phone number or area code I use? Like, and I guess along with that, is there some trick to getting people to actually answer the phone? Because I know whenever I get calls from numbers I don't recognize, like I let it go to voicemail because I don't know you. And I guess if people do that to me, do I leave them a voicemail? I don't know. Just any thoughts on how you best manage that?
Yeah. So when we're calling either with an exact match or more likely a near match area code. So an area code from a nearby county. Best practice, and this, I feel like this is regardless of lead gen source, is to call people back with a code from the state that you're operating in. The way we kind of get around people ignoring that call, and they will ignore it sometimes, is kind of setting the expectations with the seller when our caller gets off the phone. So, hey, you can expect a call within 24 to 48 hours from our local manager who will follow up with you on this. So they know to expect it. So if they see an unknown number, they might call back. Again, why that kind of follow up as quickly as you can kind of makes sense. But then the other aspect is just leave a voicemail. Like I have to do that relatively frequently. It helps when the seller said, hey, I want to be called back at this time on this date or whatever it may be, because then they're even more so expecting it. But sometimes you're not going to hold them because they're normal people and they're doing normal things. They don't have their phone on them. So just leave a voicemail. You'll get contacted back most of the time. You know, hey, talk to so-and-so. We can provide you with the name for your caller if you're a client with us. Reference name. You talk to so-and-so, my assistant, just call them back with a few more questions about your property to make you an offer on that piece of vacant land we discussed.
And then if a person just doesn't answer, like ever, how many times should I be calling them back? Like, is it 3 and you're done, or do you just do it forever?
It happens. So I'll typically call them. I'll alternate calls and text if it is a cell phone and not a landline. Usually every other day or sometimes every day for about a week to 10 days. And then I'll usually just send a final text if it is a cell phone, or I'll leave a voicemail, which goes something like, hey, it seems like you're no longer interested in selling your property. You know, I'll stop bothering you. That will sometimes motivate people into, No, I am interested, and they'll get back to you. But if not, then I just transition them into a drip campaign, and I'll follow up with them a couple months later.
When you say drip campaign, you mean drip for phone calls, not like some other type of texting or mail or something like that?
Texting as well, but yeah, typically a phone call. Like there's a whole list of, all right, this week we're following up on these phone calls from 6 weeks ago. Quickly make a dial. They pick up. Great. Hey, we had discussed buying your property a couple of months back. We got lost touch. Is that something you're still interested in? If they don't answer, then call them back the next month. At about the 6 month mark, I typically just drop them off.
Now, with all these, I mean, even if you're just doing cold calling and nothing else, but especially if you're doing cold calling plus texting, plus direct mail, plus email, plus ringless, all these other things you can do, it seems like the need for a good CRM system of some kind goes up and up and up. Because, like, how do you remember what the last conversation was and what the first one was and how that went and when you call them back and all this stuff? Do you recommend any specific type of system, or do you use anything specific that's helpful for you?
So I use Pebble. I like Pebble. Pebble's a good CRM. Pebble I got because of how optimized it was for mailers back when I mailed, but I don't mail anymore. But it still works well. It has a public form like any good CRM should have, so that, you know, my caller on my land caller campaign just fills out the form and it drops it straight into Pebble, pull it straight into a deal. You know, that's pretty standard for any good CRM. Airtable, I don't know Airtable. Airtable is a pretty popular one with, like, we have a number of clients that have Airtable. But you're absolutely right. I mean, none of our clients that are doing multi-pronged lead gen are doing it without a CRM and doing it without VAs. I don't know how, honestly, it'd be possible to try to send mail, text, and get cold call leads using Google Sheets and doing it all by yourself. Theoretically, I guess it is. But they all have VAs, and they all have pretty robust CRMs. But for somebody just starting out or wanting to bootstrap a little bit, we have plenty of clients that we are their only lead gen source. But they're just getting their leads in a Google Sheet, not spending the time working out how to maximize a CRM's efficiency because it works well enough for them.
We've actually got video tutorials explaining how to use both Pebble and Airtable. So if anybody's out there is like, what? What is this? How does it work? Check out the show notes for this episode again. I've got a ton of stuff that's going to be in there. Lots of links to these tutorials and different things. So again, retipster.com/168. So as we wrap this up, I keep coming back to this whole shy introversion thing, people who just, like, really do not like talking to strangers on the phone. and I have an interesting history with this, but for somebody like me, cold calling, I mean, I guess doing that first call especially sounds awful. Luckily, we don't have to do that because of you, but even the second phone call, whether it's the time commitment or just the discomfort with it, is there any trick to getting past the discomfort? Anything that you go through? It doesn't sound like you had this discomfort. Correct me if I'm wrong, but, and maybe the question intertwined with this is, like, what kind of person should or shouldn't consider using cold calling in the first place? Like, is there a type of customer where it's like, yeah, you don't even go here, like, do something else?
I think there's definitely an aspect of know thyself and what your kind of strengths and weaknesses are. I would argue a little bit that just the land flipping niche, like making this a full-time business or even a lucrative side hustle, very much lends itself to people that are good conversators. Like, even if you're doing direct mail and you're sending blind offers and you're only getting mail back from people that agreed to your offer, like I said, most of the time you're still talking with them on the phone. So you still have to be able to converse professionally. Part of what's helpful for some people is just a little bit of, it's almost like hype man, or just envisioning how you'd want to appear to the other person before you get on the phone with them. So, like, you're not Joe Robert. Like, when I was active duty Marine Corps and doing this as a side hustle and calling from my Google Voice number, you know, after the kids were in bed or whatever, it wasn't like, I'm not like Joe Roberts who's just got started in land flipping and I don't actually really know what I'm doing yet. I'm the owner of New Life Lands. I'm a professional land investor. We buy and sell lots of land in this space. And, like, just tell yourself that right before you get on the phone, and then act like it. It could be an act. People, there's actually a very interesting video. Go try to find with, so Deion Sanders, right? He's all the rage right now for the CU Buffs as the coach. It's fascinating. He did an interview, I think pretty recently, of talking about how he's a very, very introverted, or was a very, very introverted, shy person. But he had this goal of being a superstar, and because he wanted to provide, he's coming from, you know, a single mom who he wanted to provide for. He wanted to give her the things that she had never been able to give him. And so in college, he realized, like, I need to build a persona. And the persona is not me, but I can build this persona and then I can just go act out this persona. And I'm just acting. It's not me. So I could still be introverted Deion, but his persona was prime. And really fascinating interview that anybody that kind of struggles with this, I would say, go look it up, because I thought it was, and it's exactly that. Build a persona. You're a professional land investor. You own a successful company. You're calling them back because you know the value of their land and you want their land. And that will come through in the conversation.
That actually reminds me of two different actors, James Earl Jones and Samuel L. Jackson. They both struggled with stuttering as children. Like, it was like a debilitating stutter. Like it was very, very difficult. But both of them got into acting because this is actually a fairly common thing. I don't know what it is about acting, but when you're like reading lines and like being somebody else, you don't stutter. It's also a similar thing. Some singers, I can think of at least a couple singers off the top of my head where they stuttered horribly when they would speak. But as soon as they like go into a beat and they're singing, like they don't stutter at all. It totally clears up. And it's almost like if you can visualize who you want to be and what you want to be, you can make it happen. I think I remember hearing, I think it was Jack Nicklaus, the golfer, where every time he would step up to the ball and take a swing, he would like clearly visualize exactly how he wanted to hit it. And it would go perfect, like perfect form. It would go exactly where I wanted it to go. And that was like a huge tool that he would use to hit it right every time. It's probably a similar thing where your behavior and your actions and all this stuff kind of follow your thoughts. So you have to train your thoughts and take every thought captive.
I learned that flying helicopters in the Marine Corps. Like before I would go on a flight, especially a particularly tough, complicated mission, you know, I would sit down and typically try to do it in a quiet space in a ready room just visualize the flight, like visualize the control inputs I would need to make for a particularly tough maneuver, or when something was going to happen in the objective area, a particularly complicated portion of the flight. Just visualize it, walk through it. It's not the first time you're seeing it when you're there flying and things are shooting and you're shooting and everything's going on. So you can apply those same principles to golf, to getting on the phone to talk to a lead that's in your inbox.
Did you ever fly a helicopter upside down or anything crazy like that?
No.
Is that even possible? No. Can you fly a helicopter?
With some models, it is. There's a rumor that it's possible with the Cobra, which is the model I flew. There's a rumor that it's possible with it, but I don't know anybody that's tested it out.
We haven't done this in a while, but I want to do this because I think we got a little bit of time and I'm interested to hear these answers. So at the end of some podcast episodes, when we have time, I like to ask 3 final questions to understand more about our guests and understand how they think and how they work. So Joe, first question is, what is your biggest fear?
My biggest fear is that somebody else controls my ability to take care of my family. That was my entire motivation to get into real estate, was some things that happened while I was in the Marine Corps. And I realized that this could just all go away at a moment's notice, whether that's my life or that's my job. But somebody else is controlling whether or not my family is going to be taken care of for the rest of their lives. So that's my driving motivation, really, with anything I do, is that I'm not dependent on anybody else to provide for my family.
Yeah, it's interesting. I heard this on some podcast probably like 7 or 8 years ago, but a lot of people have this idea that like, I don't want to have a boss. I want to work for myself. But the reality is when you work for yourself, you actually have like hundreds of bosses. It's just that it's like spread out and diversified. And if one of them disappears and fires you, it's okay because you have 99 other ones.
Yeah, so, exactly.
but I hear you for sure. So what are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of my family, my kids and my wife. And there was some tough years. You know, I was deployed 3 of my last 4 years in the Marine Corps. By the time I got out of the Marine Corps, I'd been gone for almost all of my kids, more than half of all their lives. So just how they came through that experience. And then my wife standing behind me as I, you know, left the safety of a guaranteed pension, a good career, essentially just kind of left it all aside so that I could pursue my real estate companies full time. And then when I have harebrained ideas, like let's launch another company, call it Landcaller and see what goes from there. She still stands by me. So I'm probably most proud of the woman my wife is and my kids for sticking with me. And yeah.
That's gotta be hard, man. I honestly, like, I can't even imagine that. I don't think I even let myself think about it. Like being away from your family for that long. I had a cousin who was deployed he was in the Navy JAG, and he was on a Navy ship for 1.5 years out in the Pacific. And he said it kind of felt like he was just in prison for that entire time. Cause like, yeah. Maybe it's different when you're on a Navy ship. I don't know, but that's tough. So my hat's off to you. And I bet, is being a Marine, is that kind of wrapped up in your identity? Do you think, like, is it sort of part of who you are? Like, do you kind of look at a lot of life through that lens or not so much?
I don't think, I actually like to say that it is not part of my identity, and is why I was able to just walk away from it. It was a job that I took seriously, that I, you know, tried my best at every day. But ultimately, the people that treat something like the Marine Corps as being one and the same with their identity, they're let down, because when they get out of the Marine Corps doesn't care about them anymore. And many of them had left behind broken families. They may not have any faith to ground them to speak of. And so when that's your identity, what are you left with when that's no longer there? So did the Marine Corps mold and shape me and teach me discipline and critical thinking, all sorts of things? Absolutely. I probably can't even count the ways that my experiences in the Marine Corps and with the people I served with have impacted my life, but it's not part of my identity. My identity is first and foremost a child of God, a sinner saved by Christ, and then a husband, a father, a brother, a son. Those things are my identity.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. That's great to hear. So last question. Suppose you just got $100 million wired to your bank account and you're not allowed to stay on your current career path. So no more land, no more cold calling, none of that stuff. You got to hit the reset button and do something else. But you can do anything else you want for the rest of your life. What are you going to do?
So no real estate at all or just no land?
Let's go extreme. Let's say no real estate.
All right. So I would probably start and there's a little bit of real estate involved in this, but it's not the main part. So I think you can forgive me, but I would like to start like a company which finds big pieces of real estate, great areas. But what it does is it develops them out to train first responders, military, and that sort of thing in unique ways that they may not be able to otherwise. So for instance, it's very, kind of Marine Corps based, it's very difficult to get ranges, get training areas. There's so many units and everybody's fighting for the same little piece of ground on the base. And it's the same similar thing with EMS, police forces, and that sort of thing. They get a big, cool piece of real estate, maybe has a lake on it, it's got a mountain, it's got, you know, backs up the national forest, and then you can set up all sorts of good training for various first responders and military. I think that'd be a fun, something that would kind of pull from different aspects of my life. I've got a brother who's a SWAT officer who, you know, would probably be all about coming in and doing training and that sort of thing. So, and then I would also offer courses in survival, like wilderness survival. That's a big passion of mine. I did a lot of wilderness survival courses in the Marine Corps all over the world and north of the Arctic Circle in the desert. So I really enjoy that. And it would be fun to just have a wilderness survival kind of compound or big piece of land that people could come to and learn wilderness survival skills.
You ever seen that show Alone?
I love it. That's a great show. It's probably the best survival show out there.
How long do you think you would last in that situation?
I think I would last pretty long.
Yeah. Of course.
I mean, I'm definitely when I was deploying all the time, and I kind of had you have to have a mindset when you're leaving your family, especially when you're going into a combat zone, where you have to be able to flip a switch from missing them, right? Because if you're missing them and you're not focused on your job, especially in your place where people are trying to kill you, then you probably don't come back alive. So that's, I'm sure you've watched a load, you see the mental aspect is a big part for most of them, and they don't know that switch. They don't have that switch. So I think I would last quite a long time.
It is fascinating. You're absolutely right. I mean, so much of it is in your head. I mean, sometimes people have to leave the show because they're like sick or like physically they're totally worn down, but like I feel like more often than not they just like miss their family, or like they discover themselves and realize this isn't actually what I want and all this stuff. It's a fascinating show, just psychologically seeing what it's like to go through that. And it's also interesting to me, like I don't think they ever point this out on the show, but I keep thinking, like, what if it wasn't a single person on their own, but what if like two people could survive together? Because then you can start specializing, and it kind of goes back to this idea that like two are better than one, and three are even better. It's this idea that as soon as people can support each other, keep each other warm, one person can be like, okay, I'm going to look for food, you build the shelter. But when it's one person and they have to do it all on their own, it's like, it's really, really hard. And it's very difficult to survive in that scenario.
Absolutely.
Joe, thank you again for doing another conversation with me. I say another because we already did another one for the Land Elite Masterclass, but both of them were fascinating. I learned a ton. I hope the people listening to this learned a lot as well. You're a great guy. It's great to know you. And again, if people want to find out more about Joe, where do they go? Landcaller.com? Is that the website?
Yeah, landcaller.com is probably we'll have just kind of information about the company. I'm not very active on most social media. I don't have most of it, but I am pretty active on X, formerly known as Twitter. So if you want to give me a follow on there, I post not just about land and cold calling. You'll also get my thoughts on military matters and geopolitics sometimes. But I do post a fair amount on land investing and cold calling for land investors. So at Joe the Land Guy is my X handle.
And I will include that in the show notes as well. Well, thanks again, Joe. Thanks, everybody, for watching. Again, I've said this several times, but it's because there's a lot there. Go to retipster.com/168. I can't think of a recent show in recent memory where we had this much stuff in the show notes. So definitely check that out. I think you'll find it interesting. And I'll talk to you again in the next episode. Hey, folks, I hope you love what you just heard. Before you go, I want to make sure you're aware of the RE Tipster newsletter. This is something that we spend a lot of time pulling in content and conversations from throughout the RE Tipster community. We want to make sure you're aware of the hottest stuff that's going on right now. Things like active deals from other wholesalers in the community in the RE Tipster deal marketplace, or changes in the industry that affect you and you need to know about. And of course, I'm always sharing the latest software and tools and services that I'm using that I think you should know about. And if you followed RE Tipster for any length of time, you already know there's a whole lot more I could talk about because there's a lot that happens in our community each week. And this is stuff you really don't want to miss. And that's why it's so important for you to be aware of what's going on. All you got to do is take out your phone, maybe even the phone you're listening to right now. Go ahead and text the word free, that's F-R-E-E, to the number 33777. And we'll get you added to the email list so you get this newsletter and you're always aware of the most important things going on in our industry. Thanks again for listening. Again, just text the word free to 33777 and we'll get you squared away. Talk to you next time.